Hey, you're tuned in to Met Radio CJTM, 1280 AM in downtown Toronto. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Mia Johnson. Toronto has updated its heat relief strategy, which officially began on May 15th and is active until September 30th. Among some of the major changes, AC units will be distributed this month for common spaces in residential buildings without in-unit air conditioning. There will be a 25% increase in aquatic staffing at city pools after a slew of untimely pool closures last year.
We noticed that as temperatures rose, health and safety standards came into effect that closed a few pools. We apologize for that. This cannot happen again. Residents expect us to do better, and we must do better.
Joanna Bevan Desjardins is Toronto Emergency Management's executive director. She says the city is more adequately prepared this year to help residents beat the heat. But ahead of what's been forecasted already as another scorcher, some advocates are raising concerns about the lack of shelter space for people living unhoused. Most city-run shelters are operating almost completely at capacity. One physician told Met Radio the city could be doing more to protect these communities.
It's certainly insufficient. One single 24-hour cooling center downtown in the annex that will only open in the event of a heat warning is simply insufficient. People who are unhoused need consistency. They need to know what is available, where and when. And so a single cooling center that maybe is open, maybe is not, is insufficient.
So that is Samantha Green. She is a family doctor in Toronto and the president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment.
Yeah, I mean, I already see the impact of extreme heat on my patients in my family practice in Regent Park and also in my family practice at a women's shelter in the downtown east in Toronto. Extreme heat can cause heat-related illness. So that's heat exhaustion, which can quickly progress to the very dangerous and deadly heat stroke. That is a medical emergency. And then that can progress to death. Heat stroke has a 50% mortality. Heat can also exacerbate chronic conditions, things like asthma, heart disease, diabetes, mental health conditions. Those get worse in the heat. There's even like documented in the literature increased suicide attempts, for example, during extreme heat, increased violence. And so it's important that people have a cool place to be when it's extremely hot out, especially when a heat warning has been called and there are multiple days in a row of hot weather and when especially nighttime temperatures don't drop and people are suffering in the heat at night.
There's been a sharp rise in heat-related deaths. That was in Health Canada's 2025 report, which the city makes reference to in its strategy this year. Last summer, we had record-breaking heat with a total of 29 days under heat warnings, up from 16 days in 2024. And Toronto is expected to continue getting hotter. Climatologists have already speculated extreme heat could be the new normal. So, is the city meeting the moment we're in? To answer this, we talked to health and climate researcher Maureen Tolentino. She is a researcher at the Wellesley Institute, a think tank that's focused on improving urban health outcomes. Much of her work looks at mental health and its connection to climate resilience, specifically in marginalized communities or equity-deserving communities. Here's our conversation. Maureen, thank you so much for coming on CJTM.
Thanks for having me.
So we've already seen predictions that the summer will be another repeat of last year where we saw consecutive weeks of heat above 30 degrees Celsius. The city made a number of revisions to this year's heat relief strategy after addressing what the mayor said were serious gaps last year. Do you think that we're adequately prepared this time around?
You know, it's really good news that the year's plan has brought a lot of improvements. So there's been a focus on stronger coordination across different departments, expanded outreach. There's a new 24-hour pilot cooling space and increased distribution of resources like water bottles, and specifically more explicit equity language in addition to the expanded network of more than 500 cooling spaces, right? So there's been a lot of improvements to the heat relief strategy, but I would echo even the city in saying that there continues to be a need for more.
I want to talk to you about what some of those improvements will be, but first I want to get into a little bit of some of the dangers or risks. You've written extensively about the risks for those in poverty or people who are housing insecure in high heat. How are these communities disproportionately impacted by high humidex levels? When we're having hot weather, that's above 31 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, not everyone experiences heat in the same way. Those with chronic illness or disability has increased vulnerability with navigating heat. Those who are living in poverty or who are housing insecure also has increased exposure to extreme heat because of how they are sheltering every day or their living conditions as well, right? There's a lot more chances that people are not living with adequate cooling within their homes if they are housing insecure. People who are particularly unhoused or are living outdoors can have increased direct exposure to extreme heat as well. So we have to think about different populations and how they, you know, what are their unique needs to be resilient during extreme heat events.
Yeah, you mentioned the city, you know, has done a bit better than last year, but what are some of these improvements? Last year, you wrote about how Toronto's relief plan fell short for people experiencing homelessness. What stands out to you this year that you think could still be expanded on?
Yeah, I think when it comes to the strategy, it's a network of strategies, right? It's not just one approach to extreme heat. However, the biggest gaps that continues to be present in any heat relief strategy really is around accessibility of these cooling spaces, of these resources, and how on the ground marginalized communities really making use of these approaches, of these supports. Are they really accessing the cooling space or the expanded heat relief network, right? That's been a continuous concern for many who are working on the ground and who are working with these communities and these populations.
Yeah. As you said, that's something that we'll sort of have to see how it plays out. But what would make for successful implementation of these services? What would successful use of cooling spaces look like?
So the availability of these cooling spaces, now that it's expanded, does not necessarily mean that these spaces are safe and accessible and available to those who are unhoused or those who are homeless. We know that people may face stigma, surveillance, mental health barriers, things like transportation issues, even when they access public spaces like these. Some people may not also feel welcome in institutional spaces like civic centers or splash pads and things like that. And so frontline workers have expressed these concerns around the accessibility of these spaces and whether there has been things like training or awareness about how to care for homeless populations or precariously housed populations trying to access these spaces. But with expanded staffing through this year's heat relief strategy, that could change this year. So I hope that is enough intervention this year, but we will have to see.
Yeah, we talk about low barrier access a lot when we think about like food banks or safe consumption sites. When we talk about low barrier access, like an unhoused person feels safe entering a space, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean to feel safe in that space?
For someone like me who's a bit removed as a researcher, right? I can't completely answer that perfectly, but having spoken to shelter staff directly, I think it really is that person-to-person contact, knowing that the staff on the ground, whether it be community workers, shelter workers, outreach workers, These are folks who know the communities directly and who understand their stories, who understand their needs, who might really like understand them as a person, as a human being, holistically. And so what really creates a safe, accessible space is really that understanding that, you know, the staff kind of bring for these communities, and the lens that they operate from is this trauma-informed response or approach.
Yeah, there will be a 24-hour heat relief site at 136 Spadina Street that'll be designated for unhoused people. This was something that was asked for. And as you mentioned, this is a pilot project. Do you see this as a sufficient response?
It's a positive response in a sense that it's an additional space for people to go to. But in terms of the efficacy of these cooling centers, there's mixed findings when it comes to research. In America, for example, has looked at the efficacy of 24/7 cooling centers that are separate from shelters, separate from other institutions that are already embedded in the society, right? And the findings are mixed. And they're mixed because it's a question of if people can actually safely and realistically use these spaces similar to other cooling spaces. It's mixed because we're unsure if it's accessible because it's a new space. Shelter workers, for example, have mentioned that, you know, shelters are a space that are already kind of established within the community. So people know to go to these shelters for support or for relief during extreme heat events. But the 24/7 cooling centers, especially if they're pilot, especially if they're new in the system, there's less likely that people will gravitate to using them or even know that they exist, right? So it's a positive addition to the health relief strategy, but I think there is work to be done to ensure that this is integrated within the current system that serves homeless populations or precariously housed populations.
Okay, I want to move on from the strategy. I want to talk a little bit about sort of the urgency, which you've said to me previously is really a big thing that we're looking at going into this summer, the urgency of rising temperatures. The urban heat island effect is expected to make parts of the city 5 degrees warmer. What is this phenomenon and why should it be on our radar going into the summer?
So the urban heat island effect, I think that's what you're referring to, is where cities and areas that are dense, where there's dense infrastructure, experience significantly higher temperatures than their surrounding areas. It's due to closely packed buildings or like presence of things like asphalt, concrete that really absorb that solar radiation during the day. And then it releases it during the nighttime. So it creates the effect of trapped heat or islands of trapped heat. That's where the term is coming from. So for neighborhoods who have more green spaces, they don't experience this effect as much as those with less green spaces. And we know in Toronto, in the GTA, neighborhoods with less green spaces are typically areas that are low-income areas, areas that are with racialized communities or newcomers, immigrant communities, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned long-term, like how do we reduce urban heat island effects in the long-term? What are some of those strategies look like that have been effective?
Yeah, there's many ways we could do this. The most simple way to go about it is just planting trees where we can. It's as simple as that. There are a lot of retrofit initiatives that are targeted for low-income households or low-income neighborhoods that have that initiative to plant more trees, plant more greenery around their surrounding areas. And there's also initiatives that create recreational green spaces, so parks or community gardens. This allows for co-benefits to happen. So we're not just, you know, mitigating the impacts of urban heat island effect, but we're also creating community resilience, or we're building community resilience through those initiatives.
Yeah. Okay. I want to wrap things up here. I just want to sort of end on like a zoom out question. You know, last week we had the former environment minister resign, MP Stephen Gabeau. As he resigned, he said Canada is quote, backsliding, unquote, on climate action. What does that say about the state of climate resilience infrastructure?
We are increasingly responding to the urgency of climate change. I think that's very clear. Locally, we've seen a significant improvement to our heat relief strategy, as an example, right? I think we're really listening to the urgency of the moment right now. So while we have the emergency responses that we, you know, have to improve as we contend with an increasing urgency for yet another emergency that we're dealing with as a population, that also has to be paralleled with more long-term, more upstream approaches, I feel, because we cannot always be responding to an emergency as a society. And we have to kind of build the infrastructure and the systems that allow us to be resilient in a longer term period, because it's not going to change that, you know, climate change is not going anywhere is what I'm trying to say. The prevention oriented strategies are needed to reduce the vulnerability to climate change and build that long-term resilience, in addition to the emergency cooling responses that are very, very important at this time. We definitely need to improve these responses. Stable and climate resilient housing is really the strongest protection against heat exposure. And it's important to invest in these upstream approaches, the housing first models, for example, retrofitting community housing to build climate resilient communities with things like insulation, ventilation, and air conditioning that are important to have as we're dealing with more and more urgency of climate change, but not a lot of people have access to it or can even afford it, right? So in terms of housing first models, it's important that, you know, people who are living the experiences of housing insecurity and homelessness are also involved in ensuring these solutions are implemented. So how are they also being involved in the development and the planning and the implementation of these interventions? I think those are ways we can move towards the right direction as Canada, but also just locally as Toronto. How are we really thinking about and centering the people who will be impacted the most by climate change?
I think that's a great place to wrap up, Marianne. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to this.
Marianne Tolentino is a health and climate researcher at the Wellesley Institute. She joined us this week. As far as improvements go, we asked Dr. Samantha Green what more the city could be doing to keep things cool in low-income areas and for those living unhoused.
There is this 26 degree temperature bylaw for renters that was supposed to be introduced to City Council this month, is not being introduced. So that's a discussion, because that will protect thousands of renters across the city from baking in their hot apartments on extreme heat days. And I think that also when a heat warning is called, TTC needs to be free. That's another intervention that would support people who are unhoused, but it would support all people getting to where they need to go when it's very hot out. I mean, I haven't seen publicly available a list of what shelters have cooling and what shelters do not have cooling. I think that is something that the city should publish and should work towards 100% mechanical cooling in all of both city-run and city-funded shelters.
Green is a family doctor in Toronto's downtown east and the president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Okay, that's all for today. This episode was produced by myself and Pamela Hassan. None of this coverage would be possible without the Community Radio Fund of Canada's local journalism initiative. This is Met Radio. I'm Mia Johnson. Talk to you next week.